We welcome you to this audio series intended to provide information to those eligible for Air Force legal assistance, which include active duty military members, their dependents, and retirees. Our hope with this series, which we are calling The Art of Law at Hill Air Force Base, is that we can convey legal assistance information to you that is readily available, provide information that is responsive to your needs, and to do so in a timely manner. This series is for informational purposes only and is not intended as a substitute for legal advice from an attorney. Today we will be discussing divorce in Utah. My name is Brad Bell, and I'm joined by two of my colleagues in the office, Mr. J. Ed Christiansen and Mr. Darren Johns. Both are retired military JAGs, worked in private practice downtown after their military careers, and are now civilian attorneys here at Hill Air Force Base. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you, Brad.
Well, let's get to the discussion. Our office sees many clients who come with questions about getting divorced in Utah. For example, do I need an attorney? What is the process and what kinds of issues do I need to be thinking about? So, J. Ed, let's discuss that first question. Is an attorney required to process a divorce? And if not, should a client obtain an attorney?
Well, good question. No, attorneys are not required in order to get a divorce in Utah. Most cases are uncontested, and many people can actually obtain a divorce without ever hiring an attorney. But if you have a case and it seems to be fairly complicated, you need help, you need some questions answered, we can certainly help that. But as far as retaining outside counsel out in town, you don't have to have an attorney. But if your spouse hires an attorney and it looks like the case is going to be contested, you really ought to consider getting an attorney. I would never be in a position to say, no, don't hire an attorney, nor would I ever be in a position to say, yeah, you have to have an attorney. But in the more complex cases, especially the litigated ones, you really ought to consider it. Attorneys at our office, we provide free basic service. We're happy to answer questions, give you advice, even review documents that you've prepared yourself or have been served. But what we can't do, we don't go out in town and represent you in court. And if you've already hired an attorney, we generally don't see clients that already have attorneys unless we have that attorney's consent. We're not going to be put in a position to second guess an attorney and to interfere with that attorney-client relationship.
Now, just to interrupt just real quick here, I know sometimes attorneys will have questions about military-specific issues. Are you willing to reach out to those attorneys and provide that direction?
Absolutely. We look for opportunities to spread our outreach program. And frankly, very routinely, we do answer questions to outside counsel. We provide continuing legal education to civilian counsel, and probably two or three times a month, I have a number of attorneys call and ask questions how to handle certain military-specific issues.
Thanks, J. Ed. Darren, let's turn to you. We have a lot of clients who come to Hill Air Force Base from all around the country, married in various states, and they want to know, what is it that I need to do to get a divorce in Utah? How does it get started?
Well, thanks, Brad. Well, the first thing to get started in filing a divorce is you have to file what's called a petition. But before you file your petition, you have to establish residency here in Utah. So for here in Utah, you have to be a resident of the state for at least 3 months before filing the petition. But as long as one party has been a resident for at least 3 months, either party can file, whether they're the party that's been the resident here for 3 months or the other party who may not even be here in Utah. As long as you have one of the parties who has been here for 3 months, they can go ahead and file that petition for divorce. Now, the petition, it's basically a document that just tells the court what you want. It tells the court, hey, we want a divorce. Here's how we want to divide up our property. Here's how we want child custody to go. Here's how we want to divide up our debts. It's basically just you're asking the court to terminate the marriage relationship and help you to divide up the property. That's what a petition is.
And once the petition is filed, what is the obligation of the party who receives that petition? What must they do next?
So the party who receives the petition, what they need to do is review it and decide if they want to contest anything in that petition. If they do want to contest anything in the petition, they would file what's called an answer. And we'll talk about that a little bit later in the podcast, what that answer would entail and how to respond to an answer.
Very good. So if somebody were to or wanted to file on their own a JED, is there a possibility for them to be able to do that, or what is the process for doing that?
Online, there is a do-it-yourself program. It's found on the court's website. You can simply Google Utah Courts Divorce, and you'll find the link to a program called OCAP. That's O-C-A-P. It stands for Online Court Assistance Program. Or you can Google Utah Courts OCAP, and it'll take you directly there. If you've ever done anything like TurboTax, or you do your taxes by yourself, it's very similar in that it goes through what's called the interview process, where the program will ask you questions, and based on your answers, it may take you down a different decision tree. But ultimately, what it does is it will generate all the documents necessary for you to file the divorce. What it does not do, unlike TurboTax, is it will not file the documents online. You still have to physically print the documents and then deliver them to the courthouse before the clerk. But it's not as polished as TurboTax, which of course has hundreds of millions of paying customers. This would only have thousands of customers and really not paying. And but it's not bad for a do-it-yourself program without hiring an attorney. Our attorneys in our office, if you hop on OCAP and draft certain documents, we're happy to review them. A neat thing about OCAP is it'll ask you for a username and a password because you're simply not going to generate these divorce documents in 5 minutes. And because it takes a little bit longer, you may be interrupted in your progress. And you can go back in and save. And then because our attorneys are willing to review the documents, we may look at it and say, oh, don't say that, or say this instead of that. And then you can log back in and edit your document.
So once those documents are generated and everything looks good, what do they do next with those documents?
Well, it depends. One of the questions that it's going to ask is, Darren had explained that a petition will say, these are the things I want. This is how I want to handle custody or property division. One of the questions that will be asked is if you think your spouse is going to agree with these things that you want. If you answer yes, it's going to print out what's called a stipulation, which looks very much like the petition. The petition will say, I want A, B, and C. But the stipulation will say, we agree to A, B, and C. And you send that to the other party, and if they're willing to agree and sign it, then you can file that with the court. But if they're not willing to agree, then you have to serve the other party. And so instead of generating a stipulation, OCAP will generate what's called a summons, which basically puts the other party on notice that you filed in court and that you've got a particular deadline to answer or respond to the petition. And if you miss that deadline, it's possible that you could end up getting what's called a default judgment, meaning you ask for A, B, and C in the petition, the court's going to grant that. So the other party will receive the summons. And Darren already mentioned an answer, and that's where you tell the court, I disagree. And maybe the petition will say, I want A, B, and C. And then you've got the answer, the petition, and you may agree with A. You may agree with B, but you don't agree with C. So you file an answer, basically telling the court what it is you disagree with.
And in Utah, how much time do you have to file that answer?
If you are served within Utah, you have 21 days to file the answer. But if you are served a petition out of state, then you got 30 days to respond.
Very good. So let's discuss the answer a little bit, Darren. Why don't you go into what's required for that part of the process?
Okay. Thank you. Yeah, for the answer, again, the answer when it's filed, in order, well, let's back up a bit. So Jada talked about a stipulation, and it's always best if you can stipulate, reach some sort of agreement and settlement, because then you have control of the process. You control what's being done, as opposed to when you disagree, now you're giving control to a judge who is going to do things that probably neither party wants. But if there's something that you just cannot agree upon, then you file what's called the answer. And in the answer, you basically look at everything that they're asking for in the petition, and you can go paragraph by paragraph, or you can lump paragraphs together, and you just say, you know, like paragraph 1, 2, 3, 4, agree. Paragraph 5 through 9, deny. And you can have somewhere you might agree with part, you might disagree. For example, the petition may say that you were married in Henderson, Nevada on May 14th, 2003. And in reality, you were married in Henderson, Nevada on May 14th, 2004. So you could say agree in part, deny in part, and put that correction in there. But that's basically how the answer works, is you just tell the court that you're agreeing with something or that you're denying something. And then at the end, you tell them what you want is different from what's in the petition. So for example, if the petition says they want 365 days with the kids and you get no visitation time, that's probably something you're going to disagree with. And so you would say deny, and you may put in a counter petition, which would be at the end of the answer, that you want custody to be, they get 220 days a year and you get the other 145 days per year. And then that's something for the court that's, okay, here's the disagreement, here's what we're going to have to look at. But the thing with the answer is you're only going to file the answer if you can't agree on anything. So you file the answer, you're saying we're going to go to trial on this unless we can settle our differences before trial. Now, to go to trial, you're not going to get to trial within a year. It's going to take a while to get there because of all the processes and procedures that you need to go through. So it's going to be quite some time before a case is able to go to trial. And realistically, only about 1% of the cases ever do go to trial. Usually they're settled, I think, about 75% of the time during your first, what we call mediation. And then the rest are usually settled shortly thereafter.
So is mediation required as part of the divorce process in every case?
It's not required in every case. If you can agree upon everything and you have that stipulation, then there's no need to go to mediation. But if you cannot agree, then yes, mediation will be required before going to court.
Very good. So I know that we have a lot of clients who come to us with great concerns over some of the substantive issues. One of them is child custody. So Darren, why don't you talk to us a little bit about the various forms of custody and what a judge might look at when determining those custody determinations.
Okay. Well, with custody, there are basically two different types of custody, and custody is really a misnomer. You know, we have what we call legal custody, and we have what's called physical custody. Physical custody is what most people think about when they think about custody, and really what that is parent time. How much time does each parent get with the child? That's your physical custody, and I think Jed was going to talk a little bit more about that. Yeah. But you also have what's called legal custody. And legal custody basically just means that the parent is involved in the life of the child. For example, with legal custody, a parent with legal custody is supposed to be able to help make decisions for the child, you know, where the child's going to go to school, what religion the child be raised in, any elective surgeries the child may have. basically be involved in the child's life. Just because you're getting divorced does not mean that you are not going to have to deal with the other parent, with your soon-to-be former spouse anymore. And in fact, you're probably going to have to deal with them a lot more than you have in the past, because the default or the favored method here in Utah is to grant joint legal custody, meaning that you are both to co-parent together to help your child develop and mature, that you are both going to be able to be notified of events at the children's school. You have to consult together about, hey, what elective surgeries might happen? What religion is the child going to be born in? What school are they going to go to? What extracurricular activities might they be involved in? You have to work together on that. For military members, one difficulty I've seen that comes up a lot is a military member will get orders overseas. And with joint legal custody, you have to have the other parent's permission to get a passport. And so that sometimes creates a problem for military parents who haven't yet been able to effectively co-parent, where the one parent says, no, I'm not going to give you permission to get the passport. And now the military parent says, well, I can't take my child because he's not willing to sign over for the passport. If you have issues like that, come talk to us in the legal office. We can help you with that. But that is an issue that sometimes comes up when you have joint legal custody, because with joint legal custody, both parents are supposed to continue to work together for the benefit of the child.
How about the minor decisions that come up from day to day? What's the obligation when there's a joint legal custody?
When there's joint legal custody, the minor decisions are made by whichever parent has the child at the time. So a lot of times we'll get complaints about, well, you know, she doesn't have to do her homework when she's with her dad. Okay, well, that's prerogative. That's the minor decisions that are made about, you know, do you have to do homework before watching TV? Do you get to stay with a friend over at a friend's house? Do you get to go do some sort of activity with your friends? Those are minor decisions that would be made. Even decisions like, let's say the child gets hurt, they're playing soccer and they get hurt, have to be rushed to the emergency room. Even with joint custody, the parent with whom the child resides, with whom the child is with at that time, gets to make that decision to go to the emergency room, but then has to notify the other parent immediately to let them know. But decisions like that are made by whichever parent has a child at the time.
That's great, Darren. A wonderful discussion on legal custody. Now, you mentioned physical custody, which is, I know, a great concern to a lot of our folks. And you mentioned especially those who may be PCSing to another state or outside the country. So, Jayed, if you wouldn't mind taking a few moments to discuss physical custody and what a judge looks at when making those determinations.
Sure. And as Darren already mentioned, physical custody is simply which parent the child spends with at any particular given time. A lot of clients will come in and ask, and how do we figure out parent time? And honestly, the parties, as long as they're able to agree, they're able to come up with any schedule that they want, as long as they agree. And in fact, there are certain statutory schedules, about four different schedules that vary in how much time each parent gets. And the parties are free to use one of these statutory schemes or come up with their own. The statutory schemes range anywhere from an exact 50-50 parent time to the statutory minimum. And the statutory minimum gives one parent alternating weekends, midweek visits, half the holidays one year, the other half of the holidays the next, and then in the summer up to an additional 4 weeks. When you do the math, it ends up being about 100 overnights for the one parent per year, with the remaining 265 overnights to the other parent. The advantage, well, first of all, when people will come in and ask, well, how do we figure this out? And what schedule should we use? Because they can create any custom schedule they want, I try and push them towards one of the statutory schemes even though it's voluntary, because they're very detailed. They spell out all the rules and certain deadlines and such. But it's best, as Darren mentioned, it's best that the parties come up with an agreement on their own, because if they don't, then it's going to be in the hands of the judge. And it's very possible that the judge could end up with an order that neither one of them like. Additionally, if you're to sit and argue about it and litigate the issue and go to trial, that could be very expensive and time-consuming. Frequently in litigated cases, courts will order what are called custody evaluations, and these are typically done by licensed clinical social workers or child psychologists or even marriage therapists, usually somebody that's trained in making these decisions as to what's in the best interest of the child. They will talk with the parents, they'll go visit the schools, they'll visit the homes, they'll talk with neighbors, they'll talk with relatives, even interview teachers before they recommend to the court what they think. And I can't give you an exact percentage, but close to 100%, the judges will typically follow whatever recommendation that the custody evaluators make. And typically in most litigation that I've been involved with and other cases that I've observed, these child psychologists, these custody evaluators typically will recommend something that's a little more than the statutory minimum. They used to call it an enhanced statutory minimum, where they would give one parent alternating weekends, but instead of being Friday night at 6 p.m. to Sunday night at 6 p.m., it's more Friday after school until Monday morning, dropping the kids off at school, giving that one parent an additional two or three overnights a month. And the midweek visits, instead of being like 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. on Wednesday, it's like Wednesday after school until Thursday morning, dropping the kid off at school, which could give that parent an additional four or five overnights a month. Everything else is the same as long what I've already described with the statutory minimum, but instead of 100 overnights a year, it ends up being 145 overnights a year, with the other parent having the remaining 220. And that typically is where the courts go as far as contested divorces dealing with children.
But the key is if the parents can agree on the child physical custody, you would recommend that's the very best thing to do.
Absolutely. And even after there's an order, particularly with military cases, it's possible that things will change. And one of the parents wants to move more than 150 miles away from the other parent and take the kids with them. In a case like that, it's likely that it may end up in more litigation unless the parties can agree otherwise. If the court allows, decides that it's in the best interest of the relocating parent to take the kids, the parent time schedule usually ends up being half the school breaks, like fall break, winter break, and spring break. Half of those go to one parent one year, and then the other half the next year, and then up to half of the summer, as long as the kids are back in school 1 week before, or they're back 1 week before school starts.
So if you're a military member and you know that you're going to be PCSing, let's say, to the East Coast, do you have an obligation to notify the court or notify the other parent? How does that work out?
Well, the statute that we call the relocation statute, it requires that the parent wanting to move give the other party 60 days written notice.
Okay. Very good. Well, I know one of the other critical areas that people are concerned about and requesting information about is the area of child support, Darren. So can you tell us how Utah calculates child support payments?
Well, Utah has a statutory formula that they use to calculate child support payments. And just to go back to a little bit of what Jay Ed said, you know, Jay Ed mentioned these child custody evaluators and that the courts generally go with what the child custody evaluator will say for parent time. I think the last statistic I saw said that about 80%, a little more than 80% of the time, that's the case. But as Jay had mentioned, sometimes the judges are going to give a little bit more than what the statutory minimum is, and that has an impact on child support as well. Because with the statutory formula, they're going to look at both the income of the parties as well as the number of children and the number of overnights that the children stay with each parent. And the more overnights that they have with a parent, the less child support that parent is going to be obliged to provide. And so that has a key impact on the child support calculation, is the overnights that the parent, each parent is given. So by simply Googling Utah child support calculator, you can pull up this child support calculator worksheet where you're going to fill in the numbers and the information that you have. For example, say, you know, you got mom, you got dad. How much is dad's annual monthly salary? How much is mom's monthly salary? And this is income that is not just your base pay for the military, but it includes your BAH, your BAS, so your basic allowance for housing, basic allowance for subsistence, any special pay you might be getting, disability pay, any income from whatever source is put into that calculation. Sometimes, a lot of times, we'll have parents who are not working. You'll have the military spouse and you'll have a stay-at-home spouse. And in that case, the courts will impute an income to the non-working spouse. Or I should say non-working, I should say the spouse who is staying at home. But that income is going to be, that imputation is going to be based on what's that spouse's education level, how long has it been since they were out in the workplace, what could they reasonably be earning right now if they were to be working full-time. And that's what the court will impute to them as the income.
So the key to this is put in all the information that you have into this calculator, and it will calculate every time exactly what the amount that the court would normally require.
Correct.
For the child support payment.
Correct. And so we'll have dad's amount of support is this amount, mom's amount of support is this amount. And so whoever has the majority of the parent time, they're the one that's going to be paying that amount to the other parent. And that's something I get a lot of folks come in and they'll say, well, you know, I just want to get a divorce. I'm going to waive child support. Well, child support is not yours to waive. Again, this is child support. It's not mom support. It's not dad support. It is support for the child. And it goes to the child. The courts are not going to allow you to waive child support. It is not in the child's best interest to have that money waived. That money is to be used, for example, you could be, well, she's always spending money on stuff for herself. Well, that's fine. Child support is also there to help pay the rent for a larger place to have a room for the child when they're there, to help pay for the food for the child, to help pay for clothing for the child. And if that frees up some money for her to take care of herself as well, so be it. But the money is being spent not just on, hey, this is going to the child's bank account. It's being spent on, here's rent so that the child can have a room. Here is food for the child. And all those things are calculated into that child support payment. So I sometimes get very, shall we say, intense discussions with my clients to inform them that no, child support is not something that they can or will waive. It is something that has to be paid. And there is a formula for doing that. Now, occasionally the courts will allow you to deviate from what the child support calculator comes to. But those cases are going to be very rare.
Okay.
For example, if they can come up with a reason why, yes, this is my income, but I have these special expenses that have to be met too, that may justify deviation downward. More often than not, you'll have a deviation upward where a parent says, hey, I want to pay more than what's required. Well, that's great. That's fine. You can always do that. So there are times where they will deviate from that.
Very good. So another principal issue, Jayette, is the division of property and the allocation of debts in a divorce. So can you share with us the thinking that goes into dividing that property?
Sure. It's interesting. A lot of clients will ask me, How do we divide our property? How do I divide my military retirement? And all this, this may sound as a smart aleck answer. Frequently, I'll say any way you want. Because the fact of the matter is there's no set rule that you have to divide it any particular way. As long as the two of you are in agreement, you can divide your property and your debt any way you want. However, if you can't agree, then really what the courts will do, the court will want to know of all your property, what's called separate property and what's called marital property. Separate property is anything that was accumulated before the divorce, anything that was accumulated during the divorce from gift or an inheritance. Whereas everything else that's accumulated during the marriage is marital property, including your wages and your salary. That's, even though you are the one earning it, it is marital property owned by both parties. And so really what the courts will do, they'll give you your separate property. So everybody takes their separate property free and clear. That is anything accumulated before the marriage or anything accumulated before or during the marriage from gift or inheritance. Then the court will divide everything else, the marital property, generally 50-50. But there are some complications involved, and that's where you may already own some significant property, a house, or even your military retirement. You were active duty when you got married, and you'd been active duty for 5 years. That part of the military retirement is your separate property, but the part that's accumulated during the marriage is marital property. So it becomes a little more complicated in how to figure out those type assets, your military retirement, other retirement plans such as TSP, IRAs, 401ks, or even the house that was owned before the marriage. A simple rule of thumb for houses. Before the marriage, you might have this $200,000 house that you got $10,000 of equity in. At the time of the divorce, you're going to walk off with that $10,000 equity free and clear. But the rest that was accumulated during the marriage, now maybe it's a $500,000 house that's been paid for by mortgage, or the mortgage is paid for by marital property, that is your income and the other person's income. That increase in value, that's the marital property. So you get the first $10,000. But the remaining $490,000, that's to be divided 50-50. And same thing with the military retirement. That if it's a 20-year retirement, but the marriage only overlapped 15 of those 20 years, well, then that 75% is marital property, of which the other party gets half. It's a little more complicated than that. And so if you have or anybody listening has any questions about that, they should call our office and schedule an appointment with one of our legal assistance attorneys to have a more in-depth discussion on that topic.
Very good. Well, another question that comes up frequently is the spouse who comes in and says that married when they were young to the military member. The military member went 30 years in their career or some other amount, and now they're getting divorced, and the person followed their military spouse all around the country, sometimes all around the world, never had a chance to gain their own education or develop a retirement themselves or a job. And so they ask us, what's available in those kinds of circumstances? So can you discuss a little bit about alimony, Darren?
Sure. So alimony, unlike child support, there is no set formula for alimony. For alimony, you have to look at it. The courts look at two main factors. They're going to look at what is the financial conditions and the needs of the spouse that needs the support. And secondly, what is the ability of the spouse who's going to be paying the support to actually pay that support? Those are the two main things they'll look at. They'll also look at, you know, what's the standard of living they're used to living under. But the two main things are, one, the recipient spouse, what's her income or his income and needs? and two, the paying spouse, what's their ability to pay for those needs. One thing also to look at is that here in Utah, alimony will not exceed the duration of the marriage. So if you were married for 2 years, the longest alimony would last would be 2 years. If you're married for 30 years, the longest it's going to last is 30 years. So if you know you followed them around for 30 years of their military career, they're 47 years old and you're say 35, well, by the time you're 65, your alimony is going to stop and you're just entering into retirement and you just lost this big source of income. So that's something to be aware of as well. Another thing is that alimony terminates when the receiving party remarries, or if the receiving party is currently cohabitating with another person, alimony can terminate then as well. Even though you may not have reached the total duration of the marriage, it can terminate early for those two reasons there. But again, going back to the formula there, you look at what are the needs of the recipient spouse and what's the ability to pay. And you're going to say, okay, let's say the recipient spouse, you look at her income or his income, and you look at their expense, and there's a $2,000 deficit there. And the payer spouse, you look at their income and their expenses, and maybe there's an $800 surplus. Well, then the court may order, yeah, $800 or a little more, a little less to the recipient spouse for alimony. So it's going to come down to what are the needs and what's the ability to pay. And looking at that, the courts are going to look at these financial declarations that you file, and they're going to look at those pretty intensely and say, okay, well, you said here that you have to spend $200 a month on entertainment. Well, you're going to be single. You could probably get by on $100. And so you may adjust some of those funds. Or you say that you're paying, you know, a $1,000 a month car payment on this midlife crisis car. The court might say, well, you could sell that car and get something less expensive and you can afford to pay an additional $500 a year. So they're going to look at, you know, what your needs are. They may look at the needs of the recipient spouse, and she may have said, well, I need $1,000 a month for groceries. Like, well, no, that's what you have been paying for groceries, but that was with the entire family. You're now getting child support to help pay for those groceries, and it's just you. You don't have the other spouse. We're going to drop that down to, you know, $700 a month. So they will look at those financial declarations that you filed very closely to determine that alimony. But that's the general gist of how alimony is going to be determined here in Utah. There's no set formula. They're just going to look at what's the recipient spouse's needs and what is her income, ability to meet those needs. And for the paying spouse, what is the paying spouse's needs and their ability to meet those needs? And is there any surplus there to pay out for the alimony?
Well, thank you. Well, this has been a wonderful discussion, gentlemen. I know that we've covered a lot of the issues that we're typically faced with when legal assistance clients come to our office. So I appreciate the expertise that you've brought to this discussion. And just for those who are listening, I know that if you go to the website, utcourts.gov, and that's UT for Utah, courts.gov, you will see a lot of the topics that we've covered, specifically as it pertains to the state of Utah. For those who still have questions about divorce in Utah or other legal assistance topics, please feel free to reach out to our office at area code 801-777-6626. Let me repeat that. That is 801-777-6626, and you can get an appointment with a legal assistance attorney. Well, with that, thank you for listening in, and until next topic, have a great Air Force Day.